Hi, I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us tonight. Tonight I have with us Nora Gedgata. Sorry if I say that name wrong, Nora, you can fix
That's
me.
That's okay.
But we're going to talk about her fabulous book, and it really is a fabulous book, Primal Body, Primal Mind, Beyond the Paleo Diet and Total Health and a Longer Life. It really is a good book if you want to know about how do you really do the paleo diet? How do you really get anti-inflammation going on in your body instead of flaming up like a torch? So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Nora, thank you so much for being with us. And I understand that you have a second edition. I don't know if I have second edition
No,
or not.
Yes, that you have the appropriate edition of the book. There was an earlier edition that's been out of print now since early 2011. So if you've bought anything since then, you're good.
A great book, so make sure you get second edition when you go and buy it. Now, before we get started, Nora, if you'd just tell us a little bit about yourself and where people can find you and get a copy of this book.
Well, my website is www.primalbody-primalmind.com, and there are links that you can use to order my book through my website. It's in all the bookstores as well. It's a lot of places that you would normally look to buy a book, but it benefits me if you purchase it through the link on my website. And there's also a lot of wonderful free information available on my website, including quite a number of free podcasts and some videos and other things, in addition to other information products. So I think there's quite a bit there that your listeners would find extremely valuable. But I am a nutritional consultant, nutritional therapist, nationally board certified in holistic nutrition. I'm also a neurofeedback provider. I do something called neurofeedback, which is also known as EEG biofeedback, working with people's brains to help them feel and function better in their lives. So that's, in a nutshell, the background that I come from.
Well, would you tell us how to spell your last name, too, so people make sure they have you?
It's spelled Gedgaudas, and it's pronounced Gedgaudas. It's just sort of one of those names. Both my parents came from Lithuania, and that's the origin of the name, and I may very well be the only Nora Gedgaudas on the planet. I'm not 100% sure about that, but boy, it is not a common name.
So what is paleo? Let's just start with the bare bones. And like I told you before, I'm not going to do every chapter because Nora's going to come back
not.
In June. But I'm going to pick some. But the first one I want to start off and tell them, what is that thing? Why do we want to do it?
Well, basically the Paleolithic approach takes into account that, Paleolithic time period is the period of our evolutionary history that precedes the agricultural evolution, or revolution, that was about 10,000 or so years ago at the end of the last ice age. So from roughly 3 million years ago to about 10,000 years ago is a span of time that we often refer to as the Paleolithic. What the Paleolithic diet does, when you hear the term Paleolithic diet, what they're referring to is adopting a way of eating that most closely approximates what our ancestors would have seen as food through the vast majority of our evolutionary history. That if you go and you look at that more closely, you realize that the kinds of foods that would have been available to us through the vast majority of our evolutionary history would have really served to shape our physiological makeup, for starters, but also our nutritional requirements. And the closer we can come to kind of mimicking that as close as we can come to that today. It's sort of hard to find woolly mammoth burgers anymore. The more in line we are with our own sort of natural design. And, of course, the subtitle of my book is Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life, because to me that Paleolithic outlook is an essential starting place, but it's only a starting place, that we have to take into account the world we live in today and the conditions that we live in today, which are something that our primitive ancestors couldn't have fathomed in their worst nightmare. But also using what we have as modern, for instance, human longevity science, to take those concepts and tweak them a little bit, sort of find a few loopholes in Mother Nature's design that can allow us to apply those to in a way that allows us to live a much longer and healthier life than may ever have been possible before. So it covers a lot.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So do we do grains? I took my child to the doctor. My child has ADD pretty bad. And he won't eat sometimes. I had to resort to putting him on a medication as much because he won't take supplements. The doctor said, okay, we need to have a good whole grain breakfast. And I was like,
right.
He said, we've had grains for thousands of years. I'm like, wait a minute. So do we do grains or not?
Thousands of years. We're not designed to eat grains. Grains have only been a part of the human diet. You know, we began cultivating grains about 10,000 years ago in ancient Mesopotamia. Most places in Europe, we weren't adopting grains in any significant way until maybe about 2,000 years ago. In some places in the Americas, it's only been a couple hundred years. And so these are not foods to which we are genetically particularly well adapted. And in fact, the evidence seems to be showing that we're not becoming more adapted to these foods. We're actually becoming less adapted to them as time goes on. The incidence of full-blown celiac disease, for instance, has increased more than 400% in just the last 50 years alone. And this is getting worse and not better. Gluten sensitivity right now is quite literally an epidemic, and it's something that we all, very few people that I come across are not having, or I should say, have problems to one degree or another with grains, and particularly the gluten-containing grains, wheat, rye, barley. Most oats actually contain gluten by virtue of the way they're processed and stored in this country. Most buckwheat flour and soy flour are actually tainted with gluten by virtue of the way it's stored and processed. Most processed coffee, for instance, tends to have some form of gluten contamination and can trigger gluten types of reactions. And so this has become a very, very real issue. And you mentioned ADD. There was a study, and I don't have the citation handy, although I can get it to if your listeners are interested, that in which there were, I believe, 126 subjects that all had been diagnosed with some form of attention deficit disorder. It was a variety of ages. And all of these people were put on a 100% gluten-free diet for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, 100% of the subjects experienced partial or total remediation of their symptoms. And there isn't a drug out there that can possibly do what a gluten-free diet can do for that. And I'm not saying gluten is the only cause of ADD, but it's absolutely gluten sensitivity is something to be ruled out.
Certainly. Gee, that's amazing. I'd love to see that study.
Yeah.
So you have your book, I guess, and I'm gonna give you a lot of free rein. I'm gonna give you a couple of topics that I'd like for you to talk about. But you have so much information. I'm kind of just gonna let you run, as long as you'll include these topics, okay?
Okay.
I'd like for you to talk about the leptin. I'd like for you to talk about fatty acids, diabetes, and stomach acid.
Okay.
I'd really like to make sure that we get those topics in. And I'd also like to talk a little bit about, because we have this in my household, both my husband and I, the hormones converting improperly, you know, hormone testosterone and estrogen. He has the testosterone problem, and I have the estrogen problem.
Right.
And if you could talk about that, he's actually listening, and he never does that. That would be a great thing.
Well, I can tell you the number one source of testosterone deficiency is actually has to do with metabolic syndrome. It has to do with the overconversion of something called aromatization, which involves the overconversion of testosterone into estrogen through the action of insulin, or through the combination of insulin with testosterone. And so,
how do we look at that to fix it? His doctor said, if you don't fix this in 5 years, you're going to be a diabetic. And we eat grass-fed, range-fed, organic.
So his that his doctor has apparently already figured out that his low testosterone has to do with this, right?
Yes, but he's giving him the hormones, and that's
And that's the problem with hormone replacement therapy is that in the short term, and I'm sure if he's already taking the hormone, we're not even going to be able to talk to him because I'm sure he feels like Superman right now. And for a period
he's
of time,
not. It's not building, actually. It's not helping a lot, really.
Okay. So initially, a person might feel better taking the hormone, but what are you actually doing? You know, your body has decided to start overconverting testosterone into estrogen in the presence of insulin, which, of course, you need to find a way to minimize your need for insulin. And that's basically by avoiding carbohydrates, in other words, sugars and starches, as much as possible.
So does that mean no fruit? Because we don't eat any
carbs. For the time being, I think until he gets these numbers under control, I would strongly urge avoiding even fruit.
Okay.
Fructose is the most glycating and damaging sugar of all, and if his glucose levels are elevated, his hemoglobin A1C is elevated, he's going to need to get those numbers down, and fruit is not helping that.
Okay.
So for the time being, I would actually eliminate that from the diet until he's able to get these numbers under better control. At least that's the way I would be approaching it if it were me. I'm not in a position to be offering medical advice per se, but clearly insulin resistance is most closely related to an overconsumption of sugar and starch. I mean, plain and simply. There are other things that can drive insulin as well, but the primary concerns are the foods that have the biggest impact on your insulin levels, and that is, you know, dietary sugar and starch of any origin. And,
I want to cover you here, Nora. Nora's right. She's not a doctor, and of course neither am I. Neither one of us are attempting to treat or diagnose any health issue that you might have. This information that we're providing is simply that, information to help you make better decisions in your life. Sorry, Nora, I just want to make sure we get you covered.
No, not
there.
At all. I appreciate that. So, and of course diabetes is not a disease of blood sugar per se. It's a disease of insulin resistance. And unfortunately, a lot of the medications used to treat it seem to only target the blood sugar part of it by adding, or stimulating more insulin production, which is, in some respect, potentially making the problem worse over time. The idea is to restore insulin sensitivity, and in order to do that, you really do have to make some fairly significant dietary changes. But it's all very doable, and I discuss at great length the mechanisms of how all this works in my book, it's written in bite-sized pieces that are not overly technical, but the technical information is there for people who are geeks like I am and want to have references and want to understand how these things actually work on a physiological level. So a little something for everybody there. But yeah, that's
okay.
The primary reason for depressed testosterone. It's also the primary reason for depressed estrogen and actually even resistant weight loss in women is the overconversion of estrogen through, there's an enzyme actually produced in female ovaries called 17-20-lyase, which again is too much information, but But in the presence of insulin, that converts estrogen to toxic testosterone and can have women, it even gives women sometimes symptoms that may feel like low thyroid. You're having trouble losing weight, you may be losing your hair, you feel fatigued, you know, all of those kinds of symptoms. And your doctor says, oh, look, your estrogen's too low, let's put you on, you know, Premarin or something. But it may be something that is instead related to the female version of metabolic syndrome. In other words, the overconsumption of sugars and starches. Human beings are not designed to eat any appreciable amount of sugars and starches. Really, we've only developed this emergency need to lower our blood sugar in very, very recent times. Through most of our history, we didn't have a lot of access to those kinds of foods and almost no access to grains. So we're not
so really,
very well designed to deal with them.
That food chart that where it says we need whole grains, we really need to eat more living vegetables?
Well, yeah, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's food pyramid, no bias there, puts grains at the base of the pyramid as though every man, woman, and child in this world must have a foundation of grains in order to be optimally healthy. What people need to understand about that food pyramid is that there's no science involved in it at all. It is strictly politics and economics. It is not based on any foundational understanding of human health whatsoever. And in fact, the amounts and proportions of macronutrients in that food pyramid are nearly identical to the same proportions of macronutrients found in swine fattening chow. And grains are what they feed the cattle to fatten them up, so we can all take a hint. But, you know, with respect to gluten, you know, today, I mean, a number of years ago back in, I forget what year it was now, the New England Journal of Medicine had listed, you know, 10, 15 years ago, something like 55 diseases that could be caused by eating gluten. And today, that number's up to 200. Adverse health effects that are associated with gluten consumption that have been documented. And so now today there are no fewer than 80 identified autoimmune diseases with at least 40 additional diseases thought to have an autoimmune component, and gluten is known to have an either initiating or exacerbative factor in absolutely all of them. And so the implications of this are incredibly vast, and the effect is quite literally an epidemic. So you know, a lot of you may think that you haven't heard that much about this, but the fact is you hear about it all the time, every day. It just goes by all these different names that you may not have associated with the root of the problem, right? I mean, it can be everything from irritable bowel to osteoporosis and anemia and cancer and heart disease. Chronic fatigue, you know, rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and multiple sclerosis. I mean, most autoimmune diseases are associated here. But it's also linked to quite a number of psychiatric and neurological problems, including things like anxiety and depression and schizophrenia and all forms of dementia, including Alzheimer's, migraines, epilepsy, and neuropathy. It's also been extremely heavily linked to autism. So virtually anything you can imagine, gluten has the potential to play a significant negative role in. And autoimmune diseases right now are actually recognized as being the third leading cause of morbidity and mortality in the entire industrialized world, right behind cancer and heart disease. And in fact, what's interesting is that the number one cause of death in a person with gluten sensitivity is a cardiovascular event. The number two cause of death is malignancy. So there are ties even into the number one and two cause of recognized cause of death. And there's new research being borne out all the time on this subject. So grains are definitely not our friend.
Does gluten play any role I'm going to ask this question. And the subsequent question is, I just want to talk about digestion, but did gluten play a role in malabsorption?
Well, absolutely. Certainly celiac disease is a complete erosion or gastrointestinally based, allow me to correct myself, gastrointestinally based celiac disease, because celiac disease may be primarily, if not exclusively, a neurological disease, and this is a direct quote from the Journal of Neurology, affecting not only the brain and nervous system, but also cognitive and psychiatric illness, unquote. But with respect to the gastrointestinal effects of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease, there can be celiac and or non-celiac gastrointestinal damage related to gluten, and for sure that can affect your ability to absorb the nutrients in your food. But what it also is able to do is open up the floodgates, open up the gates that normally are very selective about what they allow through, and allow things to get into your bloodstream and across your blood-brain barrier that don't belong there, and cause your immune system to react in a way that generates a very damaging inflammatory response. And that can affect literally anything or everything between your hair follicles and your toenails. It can impact your brain and nervous system. It can impact your heart, any one of your organs, your joints, your whole gastrointestinal tract. 7 or 8 out of 10 celiac patients, for instance, don't have any gastrointestinal symptoms at all. It is more often than not a neurological impact that these things have, affecting mood, affecting the way your brain functions, leading to neurodegeneration, the potential for dementias. So I can think of no... There is no human being alive anywhere in the world today that has a grain deficiency. There is no such thing. There can be no such thing. There are, however, countless millions suffering the ill effects of these post-agricultural foods to which we are ill-adapted as a species in ways that, you know, nobody listening here really, you know, can afford. If you can't afford to be sick, and right now the number one cause of bankruptcy in the United States is actually a bad diagnosis. If you can't afford to be sick in any significant way, then you can't afford not to eat optimally well. And there is no way to eat optimally well that includes grains in your diet. And by the way, gluten can cause damage to your gut and cause damage to your brain, even if you don't happen to be sensitive to it, even if you're not producing an immunologic reaction to it. And that's the really scary news.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, let's see how much, where we are. We're at 20 after. I'd like to talk about digestion and stomach acid. And something that I found very interesting in this quote is a quote from your book, the double poor absorption of key minerals, including calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, boron, iron, and zinc. The double jeopardy is that it actually takes zinc to make hydrochloric acid. And then you also talk about B12, and I want to talk about those two things right there, B12, methyl donor, zinc, and hydrochloric acid. I think that, because
yeah, well,
I know a lot of people have that problem.
All that into a nutshell.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot to cover, but there's some basic things to understand about this, that you can be eating the best diet in the world. If you can't digest it, at best, it's doing you no good, but it also could potentially be doing you more harm than good. Now, digestion is a north-to-south process, meaning it starts in the brain, and you smell the food, and hopefully you're in a calm, relaxed state, because digestion is what's called a parasympathetic process. In other words, you have to be in a calm, relaxed state in order for digestion to work properly. If you're stressed or harried, rushed, or just simply unfocused on what you're doing when you eat, you may not do a very good job of digesting your food at all. And then once you take a bite of that food, whatever protein is present in that food will stimulate the release of a hormone in your brain called gastrin. And gastrin, by the way, is a thyroid-dependent hormone. So if you have compromised thyroid function, you can pretty well assume that you don't have very good digestion. So just sort of keep that in mind. But gastrin stimulates the production of hydrochloric acid in your stomach. There are these little cells called parietal cells in your stomach, and they produce hydrochloric acid in response to the stimulation by this hormone. And your stomach is an acid organ, and it absolutely has to be acid enough. I mean, it's designed. Hydrochloric acid, you know, will run a pH when you're digesting food of like 0.8, you know, to 1.5 or something like that. It's extremely, extremely acid, almost pure acid, and your stomach is designed to handle that. And your body will produce, your stomach will produce mucus in response to the production of hydrochloric acid to protect the lining in your stomach while it digests the food. But it's critical that the pH be low enough to do the job. If it isn't low enough to do the job, then things don't get properly digested and they start to putrefy in your stomach. And there's a valve in the lower part of your stomach that is waiting for the signal that the food has finished properly digesting. And unless it gets that signal, it doesn't want to start allowing undigested food through. So it kind of locks up and waiting for the right pH signal. And if that pH signal is not forthcoming, the food will just sort of sits there and ferments, and you may start producing gas, which then starts going up the other way, and you may experience that as reflux. Well, you know, 9 times out of 10, reflux has nothing whatever to do with excessive stomach acid. It is due to not having enough, not being able to produce enough. And the food isn't digesting. Your body doesn't want to accept food that hasn't been properly digested, and therefore it starts to back up the other way. And your poor esophagus, that doesn't have all that nice mucus protection and isn't designed to handle an acid load, you know, if the pH is only 3 or 4, you know, as opposed to like 0.8 the way it's supposed to be, that's still extremely acid, and it's going to burn. It's going to feel uncomfortable. And a lot of people don't realize the fact that if they have reflux problems, that it is more likely due to the fact that you're not able to produce enough hydrochloric acid, or that you have that you're just simply not producing it, either because you're too stressed, or maybe you have impaired thyroid function, or maybe you have an H. pylori infection, or maybe you're producing antibodies against your own parietal cells, which is not uncommon either, and you're unable to produce enough hydrochloric acid to do the job. But either way, that influences everything that happens down the line. It influences how your gallbladder is going to function. It influences whether or not you're producing sufficient pancreatic enzymes to digest what goes through into your small intestine. And, of course, it's going to affect certainly the health of your colon and your gut bacteria as well. So these things are all interconnected, and hydrochloric acid is absolutely essential, not just for the digestion of protein. And as human beings, we have a hydrochloric acid-based digestion. We don't have a bacterial-based digestion. We're not designed to get our protein from plants. We're designed to get it from you know, complete sources of protein, mainly animal-sourced protein. That if you're not producing sufficient hydrochloric acid, not only are you not digesting that well, but we also, because we have a hydrochloric acid-based digestion, that's how we absorb minerals. And minerals like calcium and iron and magnesium and zinc and a number of other minerals that are extremely important for your optimal functioning, those have to be ionized in the gut through the action of hydrochloric acid in order to be properly digested and utilized. And if you're not producing enough hydrochloric acid, you're not going to absorb the calcium or the magnesium or the iron or the zinc or the things that you need. And isn't it ironic that so many people in this country get their calcium by taking Tums, when Tums actually serve to basically neutralize hydrochloric acid? What do you suppose that's doing? Not a darn thing of anything good. It's just adding to the problem, and that calcium is completely unavailable to you. So that's the whole story about that.
That's so interesting. So what do they do to help increase acid and pancreatic enzymes?
Well, it depends on who you are. You know, one of the simple things you can do prior to eating is sit down and really take in what you're about to do when you sit down to eat. You know, give it your attention. Be present with it. Smell the smells. Let the juices start to flow. Maybe take a few breaths and with very slow exhalation in order to put yourself in a calm parasympathetic state. You know, deep diaphragmatic breaths, but very, very slow exhalation are the key to kind of invoking a very calm, relaxed state in your nervous system. And then making sure that you chew things really well. And again, that you remain present with what you're doing. Some people will add a little bit of, say, raw apple cider vinegar at mealtime, either as a dilute beverage, you know, a couple tablespoons in some warm water as something to sip while they eat, or just sprinkled on their food as a way of sort of boosting the, some of the digestive acidity. And some people find that that helps if they have just only a minor problem with this. For other people, the problem might be much deeper. If you have a thyroid condition, for instance, diagnosed or undiagnosed, you're going to have real problems with this. And so if you have symptoms of depressed hydrochloric acid, like, you know, you experience gas and bloating and prolonged fullness after meals and that kind of a thing, you may benefit from going out and picking up hydrochloric acid tablets or capsules at the health food store and taking those with meals. And, you know, you keep increasing by one every meal until you notice a slightly warming feeling. I have the protocol for how to use hydrochloric acid supplements safely in my book, and I recommend that you look at that, because you don't just want to pop them willy-nilly. You want to kind of go about this in a systematic way that allows you to find the amount that's right for you. Sometimes by taking hydrochloric acid, it can help improve your own natural production of hydrochloric acid, because by taking it, you're actually helping to absorb a lot of the nutrients that you need in order to manufacture hydrochloric acid. That, like, for instance, it takes a certain amount of zinc to be able to produce hydrochloric acid, but it also takes hydrochloric acid in order to be able to absorb zinc. So sometimes by supplementing with hydrochloric acid, it can improve your digestion of these foods, and over time, depending on what's going on with you, it can, in some people, help restore healthier natural production of hydrochloric acid. But you don't want to be taking it if you have been suffering from reflux and you've got a raw esophagus and you've been having a lot of burning and indigestion type problems. In that case, what you'd want to do first is make sure you take care of that inflammation and deal with that part of it, and kind of heal the damage before you start, you know, throwing acid on top of it, because obviously that's not going to feel very comfortable.
What about the role of pancreatin? A lot of people don't even know about that.
Right. Well, pancreatic enzymes, again, you know, part of the north-to-south process is that if you're not producing sufficient hydrochloric acid, chances are you're probably going to have exhibit pancreatic insufficiency as well, because some of the signaling that comes from digestion and pH in the stomach is also part of what triggers the production of these pancreatic enzymes that we need to further digest our food. And if the signaling is screwed up, you may not produce enough. So some people take pancreatic enzymes with meals as a way of better digesting their food, and I think a lot of people could probably benefit from that. If you take them away from food on an empty stomach, there are people that use pancreatic enzymes on an empty stomach as a way of addressing inflammation, for instance. And sometimes that can be helpful. But taking pancreatin or some sort of pancreatic enzyme supplement with meals, I don't have a specific one to recommend to you, is something that I think some people might find beneficial. But understand that it's always important to figure out why you're having this problem in the first place. My thinking is very foundational. It's very functional. I want to understand why these things are happening. Why aren't you producing enough hydrochloric acid? Is it because you're too stressed? Is it because you have a thyroid issue? Is it because you're autoimmune? Why? And digging down and figuring out what's actually going on so that you can more effectively address it.
So talk to us about fatty acids now.
Well, you know, fat in and of itself is something that is has been sort of unjustly vilified for the last 100 years or so. And, I talk a little bit about some of the myths surrounding all the worry about eating dietary fat. You know, dietary fat is incredibly important to us. But there, more in keeping with your question, there are some fats that are actually essential to us. In other words, we can't manufacture them any other way except by getting them through our diet. We have to get them through the things that we eat in order to have them. For instance, omega-3s, which are the most commonly deficient essential fatty acid, if you're not getting them in your diet, then they're not in your body and they're not in your brain. And the forms of omega-3 that humans are in greatest need of are these elongated forms of omega-3 called EPA, or eicosapentaenoic acid, or DHA, docosahexaenoic acid. Now, EPA, your body uses to make anti-inflammatory compounds to help you deal with inflammation, to help modulate cortisol, to help you your neurotransmitter receptors work better, all that kind of a thing. DHA is the form of omega-3 that is in your brain and that your brain most needs to function optimally well. And a lot of people run out and think, okay, well, I've heard that there's a lot of omega-3s in flax oil or chia oil or walnut oil or, God forbid, canola oil. Just don't even start with it. And the problem with that is that the plant-based forms of omega-3 are in the form of alpha-linolenic acid. They require a really complex and really extensive conversion process to ever become EPA, and in most cases will never convert to DHA. In other words, out of all of the flax oil you consume, if everything is working right, you have a perfect thyroid, you don't have any nutritional deficiencies, and you aren't of Northern European descent or Native descent or Celtic descent, which would mean that you didn't have certain enzymes that you needed to even start these conversions, you would at best be able to convert maybe 3 to 5% of that flax oil into a usable form of EPA. In other words, that is not the way we are designed to get it. The animals that eat plant foods that are designed to eat and thrive on plant foods as their primary source of nourishment, like ruminants, for instance, like cows and sheep and goats and whatever, they eat the grass that has the chloroplast that contains this alpha-linolenic acid, and they do a very efficient job of converting these things into their elongated forms, which they then store in their body fat and brain tissue, and et cetera. And the way we're designed to get it is by going and eating the meat of animals that have already done the work for us. It's how we were designed. And if you're eating the meat of an animal that has been fed on nothing but fresh green grass, in other words, it was never fed in a feedlot, nobody should ever be eating meat that spent any time in a feedlot. You may actually have higher omega-3s from that grass-fed meat than you would find per gram in wild-caught salmon. In other words, why our ancestors got omega-3s by eating wild game and animals that had been allowed to eat foods that were natural to them. In other words, just plain old fresh green grass. And what we're doing today with mainstream livestock handling and that kind of thing, with all the feedlot, with all the feedlots out there, 97% of all the beef produced is produced in feedlots, unfortunately, is we're taking animals out of their natural environment, away from fresh air and sunshine, we're sticking them in these artificial environments, feeding them foods that are artificial even to them. Cows aren't designed to eat grains. Grains make them sick. But they don't care that they're making the cow sick because they're planning to kill it anyway. But what the grains do is they fatten them up quickly. They fatten us up quickly, too, by the way. And they also, because there's no omega-3s in grains, they fill the animal up with a more inflammatory form of fatty acid called omega-6 that changes the fatty acid profile of the meat in a way that is more likely to inflame you when you eat it. So there's a big difference. We hear a lot of bad rap about meat, and what people need to realize is that the quality of the meat that you eat is directly related to the health of the animal that meat came from and the health of the diet of the animal that meat came from. And that's something that I think we all need to be more in touch with, is where our food came from and how it was grown or produced. And it's really, really important to look at these things because they do make a very, very big difference.
And I just want to say you have a lot of information in your book about, because that kind of meat, healthy meat's hard to find. In fact, I read something in your book about how even grass-fed meat are probably getting grains right before they come to you, which depletes all the omega-3s, and that concerns me because I buy grass-fed meat, and I didn't even think about that. But you have a lot of information in your book about where you can buy what kind of food.
Right. It's out there. You know, if you go to a website called eatwild.com, there's some excellent information about all this, and there's also a link to all of the people that are working really hard to try to do the right thing, raising their animals in a healthy and respectful manner in your area. You can find out who these people are who are growing these foods, and you can develop a relationship with them. Very often you can meet up with them if you go to local farmers markets and things like that. You'll find these folks. They're out there. You can contact a local chapter of the Weston A. Price Foundation, and a lot of those folks are pretty savvy about knowing who the local growers are who are doing things the right way. And sometimes these folks all go in together and maybe buy a cow together and then split it up so that it's more affordable for everybody. But they can kind of connect you with the farmers. But there are also online sources of 100% grass-fed meat. U.S. Wellness Meats is one of the best-known ones. And you can just go to maybe grasslandbeef.com is a URL that works to get there. And you can buy it by the cut and what have you.
How do you get it?
They'll ship it to you. They'll freeze it solid and they'll put, ice in with it and they will ship it to you. So you can get it that way.
Okay.
Yeah. There are lots of ways of going about it. It's not as hard as it sounds, but there's increasing demand for this kind of thing. It's growing, and it needs to grow, because grass feeding the meat that we eat is the only sustainable way to do it. Feedlots are not sustainable long term. They're very damaging to the environment. They are harmful and inhumane to the animals, and they are devastating to watersheds, and they're creating desertification everywhere. The conventional livestock practices are. You can actually accomplish the opposite of this by focusing on putting your food dollars toward meat that is exclusively pasture-fed. There is a wonderful man by the name of Alan Savory who did a marvelous TED Talk. In fact, this last year, in 2013, Alan, A-L-L-A-N, Savory, S-A-V-O-R-Y, of the Savory Institute in Zimbabwe. And, I urge everyone to run and not walk and watch this talk and understand how big a difference this can be, that by raising our meat in the right way, it can not only help reverse desertification and restore healthy watersheds. It can literally do things to impact climate change while also feeding vast human populations. In fact, it has the opposite effect of the conventional way of raising meat that's been adopted. And it's literally something that can help turn the world around and be a sustainable source of nutrient-dense nourishment for huge human populations all across the world in a way that actually restores the land and not destroys it. It's quite a remarkable thing. And really,
we've got
important.
About 10. I'm sorry, we've got about 10 minutes.
Yes.
We didn't get to talk about lots of things, but you're coming back in June.
Oh, absolutely.
So do just quickly, kind of, because I'm going to give you 5 minutes at the end to talk about anything that you want to talk about that we haven't, or even if we have. So 5 minutes. Do we eat potatoes? Do we eat things that grow under the ground?
Right.
What? Give us a little checklist of some things we buy at the store to go and fix a healthy meal for our families.
Right. So the approach to eating that I have found that seems to best optimize the health of people involves minimizing sugars and starches in your diet. These are foods, again, that were not particularly well adapted to eating a lot of. And I also advocate moderating your protein intake and eating as much fat as you need to in order to satisfy your appetite, and then eating as many above-ground vegetables, fibrous vegetables, and greens as you want as a way of adding bulk and getting extra phytonutrients and antioxidants in your diet. And however you want to eat them is fine. It can be raw, it can be cooked, it can be cultured. You can juice them as long as you're not adding a bunch of sweet stuff to it. You can add stevia, you can add ginger and lemon to give it some flavor, but I'm not a big fan of adding fruit to these concoctions. And unfortunately, most people that juice are doing the sweet stuff.
What about xylitol? Is that okay or not?
It's an alcohol-based sugar. I think that it's been a little bit hyped. I don't personally use it. If I see a little bit of xylitol in a product, I might, you know, kind of shrug and say, well, okay, but I don't go out of my way to purchase it. Some people get a lot of gastrointestinal upset with these sugar alcohols. And by the way, if you are dysglycemic, if you have a problem with diabetes or whatever, xylitol will have an impact on your blood sugar. It's a more of a delayed reaction. It's not a direct glycemic response. It's a delayed one. But it isn't necessarily a safe sugar for diabetics. So
okay.
I tend to not use xylitol personally.
And stevia?
I'm partial to... There's an herb from South America called stevia. Unfortunately, stevia now has been so commercialized, it's been put into all kinds of highly refined products and packets and with all kinds of buzz names like Truvia and whatever else, and I don't touch those. The least, either you want to get a stevia plant and you know, you just pluck the leaves and put those in things, you can get... you know, more of you know, just plain stevia powder, or there is a brand. There's only one brand that I'm aware of that is pretty much the juice of the stevia plant squeezed out of the leaves, and that's a brand called Stevita. I don't have any financial ties with them, but that's a brand of stevia that I use, and I try to use it as sparingly as I can because it's still a sweet taste that you might react to, but it doesn't have any carbohydrate. It doesn't have any sugar in it, and can even help manage your blood sugar a little bit better if it's the right kind of stevia.
What about that liquid stevia product that Now sells?
It's not the same thing. Now brand does a lot of good stuff, but I'm really fussy about this. The Stevita brand that I like is literally... they take and they squeeze the juice out of the leaves and they add a little grapefruit seed extract as a natural preservative, and that is it. And that's as good as it gets. in terms of unprocessed. Otherwise, a lot of these stevia products are pretty highly processed, and sometimes they add things to them like dextrose and titanium dioxide and God forbid, you know, all kinds of horrid things. They'll bleach it. They'll, you know, do all kinds of stuff and add other concoctions to it that make it not at all a healthy alternative. So I personally am very fussy about these things, and they're, you know, I either will use a stevia plant and just throw a leaf in a cup of tea, or we'll use the Stevita brand stevia.
Okay. Now you've got 5 minutes. Anything you want to talk about?
Wow.
And don't forget to take, because he's going to cut us off, like, you know, in 5 minutes, so, or
sure.
6 minutes. So be
I'm happy to talk about where to find you. Yes. Yeah, so finding me again, you can find me at my website, which is www.primalbody-primalmind.com. I have a free newsletter. I would love to have you sign up for that. I only send out newsletters when I have something to say, and I will never, ever abuse that and start sending you spam or sell your email to anybody. So, it doesn't cost you anything to sign up, and I really urge you to do it. Also, there's a great deal of really valuable information on my website. I have a 2-CD set that I recently released that is a great introduction to the whole kind of paleo approach and to what it is I talk about in my book. And a lot of people have found it just extremely rich with really useful information. It's something you can listen to in your car, you know, through earbuds or whatever, and just learn a lot from. And so I have that available. I also am going to be releasing a couple of ebooks in the very near future. And the first one will be on adrenal health and a lot of the myths surrounding what people think of as adrenal fatigue or adrenal burnout, and then bringing that whole subject into the 21st century where it belongs, and not in the 1950s where it's been forever now. And I'm also going to be releasing a book on the subject of autoimmunity that everybody is going to want to take a look at, because it's affecting more people today than not. And that's the silent autoimmunity explosion that most people have no clue is actually happening.
All right, you've got about 4 minutes. Do you have some things you want to talk about, or do you want me to ask some more?
Go ahead, if you have a question to ask. Yeah.
Well, adrenals was something I really wanted to talk about. Do we have time to even talk about that? 4 minutes?
Well, we can. In 4 minutes? That'd be a little tough. We can touch upon it, though, if you have a specific question.
I just wanted you to tell us about it.
Well,
what about leptin? I didn't know about that.
Right. Okay. So, leaping from
or
adrenals.
Beans. Here's an easy question.
Okay.
Do we eat dried beans? Do we eat black beans? Do we eat lentils?
Again, these are post-agricultural
foods. Do we eat black rice?
Yeah, so these post-agricultural foods are mainly starch-based. I know people think of beans as protein. Beans have more protein than, say, broccoli, but they're predominantly a starch-based food. They really are about 60% starch. And beans and legumes, legumes in general and grains, you know, contain a lot of lectins that your immune system can potentially react to. They're a very common source of food sensitivities. They also contain a lot of phytic acid, which is a substance that can bind minerals in your diet and in your body and make them unavailable to you, or even give you deficiencies if you eat enough of it over time. Certain things like rice is actually potentially cross-reactive with wheat immunologically, and people who have gluten sensitivity sometimes, in some cases, their immune system can't tell the difference between gluten-containing foods and the protein in rice. That's not everybody, but it's some people. But I think of rice as predominantly a starch-based food that is pretty, you know, has pretty minimal nutritional value, if any, to us. And so I personally don't consume any rice any legumes. I don't eat grains of any kind. And my diet mainly consists of high-quality sources of protein from, from animal source foods of a great variety. And I eat probably more vegetables than most vegetarians do, and and salads and things like that. I eat a certain number of nuts and seeds, and I tend to only eat things like berries when they're in season. Otherwise, I tend to not eat very much fruit, personally. So, and occasionally I will also have, a duck egg here and there. I have a sensitivity to chicken eggs. Believe it or not, it's an extremely common food sensitivity, and I have it in spades. I seem to be able to get away with eating duck eggs, so that, that works for me on occasion, but I don't do a lot of it. And I actually love the way I eat. It's very satiating, and it's actually less expensive to me than it would be if I was trying to eat the standard American diet, because I'm not wasting money on processed junk. I don't eat. The only beverages I drink are like tea and water. I don't drink sodas or juices or whatever. I might have the occasional glass of red wine, but that's an occasional indulgence. And I need much less food in order to satisfy my appetite. So I have, my energy is very even. And at any rate, there's a lot more in my book that helps explain this in a lot more detail, and I really encourage you guys to take a look at that.
Thank you, Nora, and I can't wait to have you back, because we're going to have lots more questions again. You have so much to say. It's a fabulous book. Thank you.
Oh,
thank
you're
you for
so,
taking
so
the time
very
to
welcome.
Come on.
Yeah, it's an honor
to
be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.